Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Thank you very much for joining us. Before we get started on this week's podcast, a really exciting announcement. Peter Hart's book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, is now available to pre-order on our website. That's right, pre-order the book. It'll be out in September, but get your hands on a copy early because anyone who pre-orders the book will also receive an exclusive behind-the-scenes interview with Peter Hart that includes wonderful audio from Gallipoli veterans telling their story in their own words. It's absolutely extraordinary. In many ways, it's even more exciting than the book, but the book's pretty good too. So get your hands on the book, pre-order it now on our website, and get that exclusive interview that you can download straight away, and then you'll get the book when it comes out in September. So Peter Hart's The Gallipoli Evacuation, now available on the Living History website, which is livinghistorytv.com. That website again, livinghistorytv.com. Get your hands on the book. It's going to be something really special.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History and a very interesting episode. We're going to be talking, doing a movie review on a new World War II movie that's just come out. It's Greyhound, the movie that's currently streaming on Apple TV Plus and starring and produced by Tom Hanks, who obviously has a great passion for military history and for telling the story of World War II in particular. So I wanted to dig into this movie, pull it apart a little bit, see how it stacks up in terms of historical accuracy and entertainment value. And joining me to do that is someone who is a very good friend of the podcast. It's James Holland. James, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Good to see you, Matt.
I'm going to kick off straight away, mate, and ask you the question. You've seen Greyhound. Is it a movie worth seeing?
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. I absolutely loved it. I've got to say, I read the book a little while ago called The Good Shepherd, which is what the movie's based on. And actually, it's pretty accurate. It's accurate in mood and feel to that book. And it just, you know, what C.S. Forrester, who is the original author of the book, gets so well is he gets inside the head of his major characters. And I think you really get that. That somehow Tom Hanks has managed to sort of transfer that into the kind of movie. So it's a kind of psychological drama, really. It's this guy who's on his first command. He's crossing the Atlantic. And you know, you have to remember that the US Atlantic fleet was involved in escort work in the Battle of the Atlantic in the second half of 1941. So actually before they'd actually officially joined the Second World War and following Pearl Harbor. So, you know, that's all kind of true to kind of form. And under him, he's got a small escort force, including a Polish destroyer, a Canadian corvette, and a British destroyer. And that's his escort force. And, you know, the challenges are enormous because it's that kind of mid-Atlantic point where air cover no longer covers you. You've got to get across that middle bit of the ground, and that's where the U-boats are lying in wait. And somehow you've got to shepherd this huge convoy of kind of 40-odd ships across that bit with no other air cover. The key thing about air cover is that most a U-boat, a particular Type 7 U-boat, isn't actually a submarine. It's what's called a submersible. In other words, it spends most of its time on the surface, but can submerge when required. The problem is the moment it submerges, it loses speed. So what you really want to do is try and get them to submerge as quickly as possible. Obviously, you want to destroy them too, but you want to get them to submerge. And that's where air cover is really, really important, because as soon as a U-boat is on the surface and sees an aircraft flying over, it dives so it can't be seen. And therefore it slows down, and therefore that's how you can sort of avoid getting them caught by catching up with the convoy. But of course, in the middle of the Atlantic, where that air cover doesn't exist, it is down to the surface vessels. And in 1941, early 1942, you know, technological advances to the Allies in hunting submarines has really taken a massive leap forward. But it's still a very imprecise science, and it's incredibly difficult to hunt down these U-boats. And that's what you're getting with this US destroyer commander and in charge of all the four escort vessels, somehow having to kind of second guess. And there's so much to think about, because he's got to think about the wording that he uses when he is communicating with the other vessels. He's got a Polish ship, Canadian and British. He's got to think about, he's trying to try and second guess the U-boat commanders. He's got to handle things like how many depth charges does he use in one go, because he doesn't know how long the fighting's going to take place. So he's got to kind of, you know, marshal those a little bit. And he's also got to kind of think about fuel and a whole host of other factors. So there's just so much responsibility on his shoulders. And both the book and the movie do this brilliantly of showing just what responsibility is on the shoulders of that captain.
I think I've always thought that the Battle of the Atlantic is a very difficult aspect of the Second World War to portray in an entertaining way on the big screen, because so much. I mean, I know there were moments of absolute terror on the high seas, and some of the most, you know, engaging stories of the Second World War took place during the Battle of the Atlantic. But at the same time, there were just weeks and weeks of boredom. You know, convoys could go out and not even see a submarine, not even see a ship. That was probably the norm more than the exception. You know, that there were thousands of ships traveling across that channel, and you know, actually running into a submarine was probably the exception rather than the rule. So I think they did a pretty good job in that way of compressing that tension and that drama and the terror that does occur when they run into a submarine into, 90 minutes on the screen.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, you know, it's something like 84% of all convoys were unchallenged, you know, which is a heck of a lot. And, you know, the kind of the highest proportion of sinkings came with stragglers, you know, those ships that kind of, you know, the engine's playing up or something, and they're kind of, you know, it's exactly the same as the kind of bomber formations going over, you know, daylight bomber formations going over Northwest Europe. You know, if you run into trouble and you suddenly find yourself isolated and alone, you're really, really up the creek without a paddle. But if you're in the convoys, that's the whole point of having the convoys, is this kind of safety in numbers. And it's exactly the same principle for having kind of mass formations of heavy bombers as well. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. A lot of it was very mundane, very kind of, kind of just clocking through the hours, sort of miserable conditions. I mean, Nicholas Montserrat's famous novel, The Cruel Sea. I mean, it's called The Cruel Sea because it's just so brutal, kind of operating in the Atlantic, particularly, of course, in winter, but it can be just as bad in summer as well. You know, it's cold, it's windy, you know, you're wet through all the day long. And I think, again, I thought they did that really well, that aspect of Greyhound, really, really well. That's showing, you know, just how much rain and how much water is being flung at the bridge and across the ship, generally speaking. I mean, it did look completely miserable, which I think is a sort of key part of the Battle of the Atlantic. So, yeah, I thought they did that really, really well. But just imagine, you know, if you're on one of those convoys when the wolf packs do strike you, you know, the odds suddenly are, you know, completely shifting. And as a commander of the escort force, wow, what a lot of responsibility. I mean, you know, because every decision you make might result in the loss of hundreds of men if you're not careful, you know. So you've just, wow, I mean, I'm just totally in awe of those guys. And I think the other reason we don't know much about the Battle of the Atlantic is, of course, you know, you can go and visit the beaches of Normandy, or you can go to kind of sort of Bougainville or wherever you want to go, or Guadalcanal, etc. You can sort of wander around those places. But you're not exactly going to take a ship to the middle of the Atlantic, kind of look around the sea and just go, wow, this is where it all happened, and then kind of, you know, sail on to New York, are you? So, you know, it's kind of not in the public consciousness in quite the same way, I think, as sort of land battles are.
Having said that, I think it's probably the element of the Second World War that is, in a strange way, it's very sexy. People do love the story of these brave submariners going out for weeks at a time and doing their best to intercept a convoy and sinking their ships and dueling with the surface vessels. There is a very sexy element to it. And I don't think there's really probably another aspect of the Second World War that combines so much boredom and tedium and no action occurring with these just, you know, this outstandingly fascinating aspect of warfare on the high seas. The two of them are at complete opposite ends of the spectrum, but then come crashing together when these submarines did run into a convoy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Battle of Atlantic is an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, for me, it's the most important battle of the entire Second World War because of the geographical positions of Canada, the United States, North America, and Britain. And so much of defeating Nazi Germany, and I think rightly the Allies kind of see defeating Nazi Germany as the number one cause of the Second World War, with the battle against Imperial Japan taking second place. So that means that Britain is really your launch pad. So that everything that you want to achieve that victory on land against Nazi Germany, and indeed in the air, has to come through the Atlantic, whether it's coming from Australia, whether it's coming from New Zealand, South Africa, the Far East, Canada, the United States, everything is flowing to Britain through the Atlantic. So if you can't secure your sea lanes, you're in big trouble because, you know, Britain becomes a huge manufacturing base in the Second World War, but an awful lot of resources come from elsewhere. You know, oil, for example, most of it's oil coming from Venezuela and from the US. You know, that's the absolute lifeblood of anyone's war effort. You know, it's one of the reasons why the Nazi Germany fails is because it doesn't have enough oil. So really, you know, if you can't secure the Battle of the Atlantic, if you can't win the Battle of the Atlantic, you know, the Allies really are in big, big trouble. And of course, Britain early on in the war goes to enormous efforts to push most of its R&D, its research and development effort, into winning the Battle of the Atlantic. So you get, you know, developments in high-frequency direction finding. You get massively new... you get the cavity magnetron, which is what reduces the size of radar from huge great masts and great big dishes and stuff to something that you can put on a corvette or a destroyer or indeed on a very long range aircraft. You know, and again, these are kind of sort of game changing developments in technology, which are actually in place by, you know, May 1941. So I think you can argue, and probably argue convincingly, that the Battle of the Atlantic has got into a position where Britain and subsequently the Allies are not going to lose the Battle of the Atlantic by the end of May 1941. But as we know, it's not until the middle of May 1943, 2 years later, that the Battle of the Atlantic is absolutely won. And that is also crucial because, of course, what you've got coming up is enormous operations in Sicily. You've got operations in Italy. You've got operations, of course, the opening of the Second Front, Normandy, Operation Overlord and all the rest of it. You can't prepare for those if you don't know what shipping's coming across. And actually, it's not just about making sure that the vast majority of your shipping is safely crossing the Atlantic. It's also making sure that you can plan. And, you know, shipping cycles take months of planning, and therefore very much months ahead of each other. So you think of, you've got this incredible network of ships coming from Australia, from South Africa, from, you know, the Indian subcontinent. They all take different times to reach Britain or from Britain to get to those places. All that has to be thought through so that they can all come together at the right time when you need the mass of that material for your land operations. So the Battle of the Atlantic is this incredibly complex beast. And what's really interesting is, of course, you as an individual merchant seaman, or you as a commander of a destroyer in the Battle of the Atlantic, you're probably not really seeing that big picture. What you're just seeing is, I hope I get across the Atlantic in one piece and I don't end up being kind of fish bait. You know, and that would sort of play on your mind a huge amount. But behind this is this kind of huge machine, this huge technological advancement, which the Allies are pushing forward to ensure that they do win the Battle of the Atlantic. Conversely, the U-boat arm begins the Second World War with just, you know, 3,000 personnel, and it's just not big enough. So, you know, even during the first happy time, and the happy time is when the most of the convoys are going through unescorted because most of the Royal Navy is on anti-invasion watch in Southeast England in 1940. This is what the U-boat crews called the happy time. But there's never more than 14 U-boats operating at one time in the entire battle of, you know, in the entire Atlantic. The Atlantic's a big old place. You know, even by January 1941, there's no more than 6 U-boats operating in the Atlantic in that month. You know, at a really crucial period of the Second World War. And the problems that the U-boat arm has is you've got these guys, these incredibly experienced U-boat commanders at the start of the war, because they've been in the force for a number of years. Their seamanship is second to none. But of course, there's a kind of gradual attrition. And in between March and May 1941, three of the biggest aces, U-boat aces that they have, Preen, Shepka and Kretschmer, are all lost. You know, Kretschmer's taken prisoner, Preen and Shepka get killed. You know, and you can't replace that. So by the time you get to kind of late 1942, early 1943, where the U-boat force is, you know, able to kind of sort of operate kind of 100 plus U-boats at any one time, it's too late because the experience levels are just going lower and lower and lower. And I'm not quite sure when Greyhound is quite set. I think it's kind of early 1942, when the very, very few American vessels operating across the Atlantic at that time, because, of course, it's post Pearl Harbor, so they're now over in, you know, in the Pacific. You know, that's the main effort for the U.S. Navy at that point. But by that stage, you're at that interesting kind of tipping point where the efficiency of the U-boat arm is sort of is going against them in terms of experience. And the Mark 7, although there's Mark 9s as well, the Mark 7 is the kind of standard U-boat. And it's just not really improving. You know, it's kind of flatlining in terms of technology, whereas Allied technology is increasing massively during that period.
Well, I suppose there's only so much they can do with a submarine, isn't there? I mean, the limitations of how it operates and what it can do compared to a surface fleet. I mean, there's only so much that the U-boat fleet can be doing to keep up with the Allied technological advancements, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they've got the Type 21 in the offing, and the technology for the Type 21 is there actually before the Second World War starts. So, but it's just not kind of pushed forward by the Nazis because, you know, U-boats aren't as sexy as battleships. You know, where's the fun in cracking a champagne bottle against a submarine compared to a massive, great battleship like, I don't know, like the Tirpitz or something? You know, and Hitler likes things that are big. You know, so the Zed plan, which is a pre-war naval expansion plan, is definitely kind of a massive own goal because they're never, ever going to compete in terms of a surface navy with France, frankly, but certainly not Britain, which has the largest navy in the world at the start of the Second World War, and obviously subsequently United States and even Canada, for that matter. So, you know, what they should have done in the 1930s is to build up a massive U-boat fleet, because it was U-boats in 1917 which nearly kind of, you know, did for Britain's war effort in the First World War. So, you know, it seems to me insane that they don't kind of concentrate that in the 1930s, but, you know, thank God they don't. But the Type 21 is fascinating because, you know, that is sets the bar for the post-war true submarine, and it can operate faster under the surface than it can on the surface. And it is a total game changer. And, you know, fortunately, only I think it's something like 2 ever get operational, and that's not till late April 1945. You know, so it's just too little too late. The frustrating thing from the German point of view is that they have that technology at the start of the war, but they don't give it enough focus and push to get these into action quickly. So, yeah, you are stuck with these Type 7s and Type 9s because there's no alternative. And you can never get away from that problem that they're much slower under the surface than they are on the surface. And the other thing that they never quite nail is their torpedoes. You know, a lot of them are duds and they just can't quite get the trigger mechanism quite right, you know, which again is very much to the advantage of the Allies. But what you're seeing in Greyhound and brilliantly depicted is lots of U-boats operating on the surface. And although in the film they just seem just a teeny bit too close for my liking, you know, I'm prepared to forgive that because what it does show is that most of the U-boats are not under the water. They're actually on the surface, which is absolutely true to form.
Well, I know that the movie is obviously intended to be entertainment, and as I was watching it, I actually wished it went on for a little bit longer. It was relatively short for a film, and they sort of dove straight into the action. Tell me, from your position as a historian, it's probably difficult to take your historian hat off sometimes, but what do you think in this movie that they did really well? What parts of the Battle of the Atlantic did they depict accurately? What part of the story did they tell well?
I mean, what they just the sort of intensity of the operations when you're in the middle of a convoy, when you're escorting a convoy and you're under wolf pack attack. I thought they got that intensity really well. The decision making process that Tom Hanks's Commander Krauss has to do, I thought was really, really well done. All the language was correct. You know, the mood, the kind of feeling, the kind of interplay between the various officers and ratings on the ship. That all just felt true to me. I thought that was really, really good. And also just the kind of, the mad hammering of guns and stuff. It would have been like that. I think that was really well, really, really well done. So I thought most of it was great, actually. And I'm a big fan of using CGI. I think it's much better to use CGI rather than to use reality and get it wrong. That's my big beef with Dunkirk movie, for example. I know Christopher Nolan has this thing that he doesn't really like using CGI, but it was a poorer film as a result of that, because you never got the sense of vastness of Dunkirk. You never got the kind of mass of ships that were out at sea. You never got the ships loading up from the mole, because you just didn't see them, because he didn't have any ships that he could use that were real. You had Spitfires flying in Vics of 3 when, they're not. They're going to be operating in 12s and certainly not at kind of sort of 4,000 feet, or 2,000 feet or even 500 feet. They're going to be way up. So, I thought all that was a real problem. Whereas the great thing about Greyhound is you have no alternative but to use CGI. And CGI is so good now that I don't really see there's any issue with it. And also it's interesting, how they do CGI is what they would do is they would photograph something that is real like a zillion times, and then you build a digital picture. So in a way, it's sort of real. If you wanted to depict a Catalina flying over, for example, you would take that Catalina, you would photograph it every which way possible, put it together on a computer. So what you're seeing is footage of a real Catalina, but just reconfigured in a digital format. So, again, I thought all that was really, really good.
As a technical achievement, the thing I really liked from a technical perspective was that they married up. So they shot a lot of it on a World War II destroyer as a static museum ship. They shot a lot of it, the internals there. Then obviously they had these huge elements of CGI. And what a challenge to recreate the Battle of the Atlantic, with ships that weren't there and gunfire and the whole thing. But I thought they married it up really, really well. I think sometimes these movies either end up like that dreadful Pearl Harbor movie where it's all CGI and you feel like you're just watching a computer game. Or perhaps, as you say, at the other end of the spectrum, like Dunkirk, where they're committed to the art of having actors and real ships and real planes in the picture, and therefore it feels a little bit lacking. I thought this was a great example of where they married up both of those elements very, very well. The live action, the real stuff that they'd filmed on an actual ship with the CGI. I thought they did a brilliant job of marrying it up. I was very impressed with that.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was absolutely terrific. And the problem with Pearl Harbor, well, there's so many problems with Pearl Harbor, but one of the problems with Pearl Harbor is, all the planes when they're attacking, it's like watching Star Wars rather than watching a Second World War film. Planes just don't operate with that agility, that maneuverability and that speed. So when you're doing your CGI, you've got to create it so that it looks realistic. The proportions are right. The proportions of size to speed across the screen and all the rest of it. That's the difficult thing to do. I mean, there was I saw a bit of criticism on Twitter about the kind of, did a destroyer really kind of lurch around the sea with such speed and also, and the answer is yes, it absolutely did. I mean, destroyers could do kind of, 42 knots. I mean, that's seriously quick. And when you really, really had to. And if you're doing a tight turn, of course you're going to be sort of leaning over and the sea's going to be switching over your kind of foredecks and all the rest of it. I mean, that's exactly what it was like. I mean, if you read any accounts of people that were operating in the Atlantic, as I was saying earlier on, Matt, these guys are soaked to the skin, literally 24/7 the whole time they're on that convoy. I mean, you just never get a chance to dry out. I also thought what was really good is, I really urge people to read the book actually as well. It's fantastic. And just because you've seen the movie wouldn't detract from the novel at all. But it's that sense of just being on your feet the whole time, just having to concentrate the whole time and not having enough rest. And I think that's something that you experience, in whatever kind of walk of life you're undertaking in the Second World War, whether you be a soldier on New Guinea, whether you be, a bomber pilot, whether it's that kind of that sleep deprivation that you get at certain times, and yet you've still got to kind of find the way through. And I don't know about you, Matt, but I mean, I know what I'm like when I haven't got enough kip. You know, I find it hard to focus. You know, your eyes start to sting, don't you? You just feel really kind of, your shoulders drop and all the rest of it. And I thought what they did so well, and what Tom Hanks does so well in this movie, is portray, give a flavor of what it's like being an escort commander when you're under attack by U-boats.
I liked that element of it, James. It's a great point that it really is a story about the people involved. And we know that Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg and the work that they've done before, I know Spielberg wasn't involved in this picture, but we know that these guys are committed to telling very intense personal stories. Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, The Pacific. I mean, they've got the Mighty Eighth is coming out eventually, which I'm looking forward to, about the Air Force. But I thought this was really a tale of people on these ships. It wasn't so much a tale of the ships. It was a tale of how did the people on the ships go. And I thought they did that very well as well.
Yeah, I mean, I thought a sort of, a 90-minute period of human drama, it was pretty... It pretty kind of hit all the marks. I mean, I would give that film a really high rating. I really enjoyed it. I every time a new Second World War film comes out, you kind of, as a historian, you go and watch it with a certain sense of trepidation. I mean, there's some new film that came out about D-Day, and it's just an absolute horror story of awfulness. And just every cliche under the book. And I thought, this is just... It's just such a joy when you watch something and you go, you know what? This is actually really good. They've got the historical detail right. This has got the flavour of the novel absolutely right. The performances are second to none. You know, it's ticking all the right boxes and I'm being hugely entertained. You know, what's not to like?
Those depictions of friendly fire that you mentioned earlier, when all the ships are just blasting away at U-boats as they come into the group, and there's shells and bullets flying in every direction. That was some of the most harrowing scenes of the whole film.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was great. I also liked the fact that, you had the U-boats kind of intercepting on the radio and kind of giving all that kind of creepy chat and stuff. And that really did happen. They did do that from time to time. And, that sort of psychological warfare, I thought that was really good. And that sense that the U-boats are, and this is, again, it's told from the whole novel, and indeed the film is told from the point of view of Tom Hanks's character. So that's who you're seeing the whole thing through his eyes. So that's why you don't see U-boat crews. You hear the voices occasionally because of the U-boat crews, because that's what he's hearing. But they are just this sinister menace with their kind of sort of wolf paintings on the conning tower and all the rest of it. And when they do emerge, you would have felt like you're being stalked. I mean, they're called wolf packs for a reason. They hunt together. They're hunters. You are hunted. And that psychological effect, I thought, came across really, really well. And it doesn't matter how terrifying it is if you are actually a U-boat crew, and how much, as a member of the U-boat crew, you would feel like the ball is on the other foot. From the perspective of a destroyer escort commander, that's what you're looking at. And I thought they portrayed that absolutely stupendously well.
It's a really great point. I think that one of the failings of war movies often is, particularly from the Allied perspective, is the enemy is always portrayed just as this sort of shadowy figure. You never see the enemy in any three-dimensional capacity. They're always just this stock standard feature of the movie that is required to help the plot progress along, which was what happened in Greyhound. But I thought it worked to very good effect here, because had they shown the scared U-boat crews who didn't want to die, it would have broken that illusion that you had from the perspective of the surface ships that you were being hunted by ghosts. You couldn't see that they're under the water, they attacked at night, and then they disappeared, and you just couldn't see them again. And this terrifying feeling that must have been with the crews of these ships every day, that they were being hunted by an unseen enemy who was going to appear at a moment's notice. The torpedo slamming into the ship was the first thing they were going to know, that there was a U-boat around. So I thought in this instance they did a really great job of only depicting the enemy as these shadowy, aggressive, arrogant members of the story. It was really well done.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think you've got to judge something on what it's setting out to do. It's not setting out to tell the story from two perspectives. It's telling it purely from the perspective of the destroyer escort commander, the Tom Hanks character. And from that point of view, absolutely, it completely nails it. Yeah, I thought it was a terrific movie. I really, really enjoyed it.
What did they get wrong? What bits would you like to have seen them done differently?
I don't know that I would have changed anything, really. I mean, in terms of kind of realism, the U-boats were just getting a little bit too close sometimes.
Yeah, their commanders seem to have a bit of a lack of respect for the safety of their own U-boats. It seemed they were determined to get in there, and they were uncautious.
Yeah, although having said that, I remember talking to the number one, who's a second in command of a British submarine operating in the Mediterranean, and in May 1941, they got within the destroyer screen of a Italian troop ship and sunk it. Because their ASDIC was out, so the only way they were going to get it was getting really, really close. So they did get in there, and they got depth charged 36 times, and survived. And the commander got a VC for that, and my friend got a DSC. So they did do that. It's not entirely unrealistic, but no, I don't really have any kind of grumbles with any of it. Really, I thought it was all really, really good. And it's just fascinating hearing the language and the kind of the commands they're using and the kind of terminology and the contact with the other boats, the kind of telephone network that they have to kind of link them to the other escort boats. All of that was absolutely as it was. So I would give it very, very high rating.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't have high expectations for it when I saw the trailer, because it was one of those movies where the preview was, a bit over the top and a bit patriotic and, America saves the day again. I thought, what's this going to be like? And then I saw it and I thought it was absolutely great. Just a really great piece of entertainment. James, thank you so much. It's great to get your opinion on these things. It's always, as I said, it's difficult sometimes for us to take the historian hat off and just sit back and enjoy a good piece of entertainment. But I think Greyhound certainly qualifies as a great piece of entertainment, which it set out to do. So thank you very much for your thoughts on it.
No, pleasure. Always good to see you.
So Greyhound is currently streaming on Apple TV Plus. So both James and I would recommend you check it out. James, thanks for your time.
All right. Cheers, Matt. Take care.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.